Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 28th, 2003. Today's session is entitled A Dynamic Down-to-Earth Concept of God, Session 1 of Healing the World, Ideas, Perspectives from Luther and the Lutheran Tradition, presented by Daryl Jodoc, number JOD 2003-01. Let's listen in.
As you know, all of these are recorded in there. Possibility of getting them later and so on. So let me introduce myself. I'm Daryl Jodoc. I teach at Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, Minnesota. And the topic that I'm trying to talk about is for the whole week is healing the world, ideas, perspectives. Oops, perspectives needs an R. From Luther and the Lutheran tradition. And the particular topic for today has to do with a dynamic down-to-earth concept of God. The minute I hear that, I've been to three sessions today, and all three speakers have sat down when they've talked. But I'm
the
person who wants to stand up and and what?
So you're feeling dynamic?
I'm feeling dynamic, that's right. So if you'll allow me to pace and to talk by standing up and not feel like that's a problem, I'll do that. And I also am aware that that people might come with very different backgrounds to this presentation. And so I think I'd like to do some presenting before we get to conversing about the ideas. But on the way to that, if you have a question about what I'm saying in terms of understanding or asking me to explain something, please stop me and we'll take time to do that. But then if you have comments about or objections or want to discuss something, maybe write a note to yourself about that and we'll come back to that later on in the session. If that's a workable way to proceed, we'll try it that way. When I wrote this up here, I was thinking about the privilege of being a college teacher and reading examinations and papers. You sometimes get an interesting education. One student wrote on a paper, according to the Yahwist, God is cement. And I tried to figure out what in the world I had said that would have caused this student to write this. And I finally realized that I had said that the Yahwist had a concrete down-to-earth image of God. And it came back, God is cement. And then as I was thinking about that, it moved me to think about my predecessor in Allentown, Pennsylvania, at a college, Muhlenberg College, who had a student write, "In Luther's day, things were so bad that priests were committing celibacy openly in the streets." And ever since I heard that, I wondered what was going through that student's mind. Well, we could go on and on with those stories. But at any rate, my feeling is that in the Lutheran Church, there's been a tendency, and by people outside the Lutheran Church, looking at the Lutheran Church, there's been a tendency to focus too narrowly on some aspects of Luther's thought. So this week, I want to try to pick up other aspects of Luther's thought that are very important, but are sometimes lost. And if they're lost, then the larger context of what he's saying is lost. And if they're lost, then it seems to me we have very poor resources for dealing with the theme of the healing of the world. On the other hand, if we remember, reclaim, pick up some of those other ideas, we have some really interesting ways to approach that larger theme of healing the world. So I'm going to try to do a series of these things in different ways. Now, to refresh our memories, the place where the attention most often goes is to his discovery of the gospel, his discovery of the insight that God is the one who justifies rather than God being the one that demands justification. And the tradition has formulated that as justification by grace through faith, being made right with God by a free gift through the acknowledgement of the human beings through their faith. Now, that's important. Should not be lost sight of, and I don't want to dismiss it, but I want to supplement it. When I try to teach that concept in college, I tend to fall back on two stories. One story to illustrate what it means to live under the law, which is Luther's expression for living with a demanding God. And that story is told to us by one of our friends who was a teacher in a high school, or junior high school. And the guidance counselor walked into her classroom one day and said, "This so-and-so is obviously emotionally going through some emotional difficulties. Let me tell you what happened. When he was 5 years old, he was orphaned, and he was placed in a foster home. And the people in the foster home, parents in the foster home, said, 'If you are good enough, we will adopt you.' At age 13, they decided he would never be good enough and asked him to be placed someplace else." You can imagine the emotional devastation that meant for him. And you can imagine the turmoil of living for 8 years under "if, then we'll do something." Okay? And that's the kind of situation that Luther lived under with regard to God. If you do all that's within your power, then God will do what's left that needs to be done in order to make up for salvation. And that "if you do all that's within your power" is what put him into a religious turmoil and problem, which became also a theological problem. The breakthrough then into gospel-oriented understanding of God can be illustrated perhaps by another story of another 13-year-old boy who was giving the authorities that were in charge of foster homes all kinds of problems because he'd be placed someplace, in this case, well-meaning foster parents. They'd come back in tears. He's disruptive at home, he's disruptive at school. And in utter frustration after this had happened over and over and over and over and over again, they decided, "We've got nothing to lose. There is this older couple that's been bugging us that wants us, and they don't meet the rules and they don't meet the regulations and so on, but let's try it. What do we got to lose?" So they placed the son there, the boy there, and parents never came back, the foster parents. And they got really curious. They kept waiting for the door to open and the tears to come. And they got really curious, so they went and talked to the parents, and they didn't get a very good answer from them. And they went to talk to the school officials, and they didn't get a very good answer from them. The boy, you know, wasn't perfect, and things were not swimmingly great, but they were better than they had been, and they were tolerable. Talked to the neighbors, they didn't get a very good answer. Trying to figure out what was different in this case. And finally, in frustration, they sat down and they said to the parents, "Now tell us exactly what you said and did from the very moment this young man set foot in your house." And they said, "Well, we knew this was our only chance. And so the first thing we said to him was that as far as we are concerned, you are our son no matter what." Okay. And from that security, then other things could build. And so Luther's insight is that God is like the second set of parents saying, "You are my child, no matter what, as far as God is concerned." So this is the one core idea with which most people familiar with the Lutheran tradition are familiar. I tried for a long time to teach Lutheran theology as all oriented around a single point, but discovered it never worked. And so the second central core idea that needs to be there is, in order to understand the distinctiveness of what Luther was saying, and to some extent the distinctiveness of the Lutheran tradition, we have to put into place a second notion, and that's a particular idea or image of God. And my theory or hypothesis is that in order to understand Lutheran theology, if you were to start with both of those ideas as central, then one, most of the rest of Luther's ideas could be understood. They grow out of that center, two centuries.
Just to put this in perspective,
sure.
The timeline on this is about like 1500, mm-hmm. Approximately.
Yes.
And this is Germany?
Yes. Well, yeah. Germany before it's a united nation, or before it's
Bavaria.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Saxony is actually the the place where he was living and working.
Okay, so that kind of area between France and Germany there, that sort of...
No, it would be in what would have been Eastern Germany, in the divided Germany.
Okay, so closer to Austria then?
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
And then the reigning church at that time was the Catholic Church?
Correct.
And so this is who he's breaking with these ideas?
Correct.
Okay.
And he's not... And to be clear, the particular theologian whose ideas he was taught, mm-hmm. not that he knew him personally, but the ideas that he was taught, was a man by the name of Gabriel Biel, B-I-E-L. Mm-hmm. And Biel's ideas were not necessarily representative of all of the theological thinking of that time. Mm-hmm. But his experience of not being able to measure up, and his experience of living under constant demands, mm-hmm. Was so typical of the experience of many people in the territories of Germany at the time, mm-hmm. that he, when he worked these through and found a way to address his own religious concerns, it spoke to the concerns that other people had as well.
Wasn't he afraid of a heretical break that would result in inquisition and torture?
Yes. In fact, he expected. He expected to be martyred for most of his life.
Okay.
Because it was when he was appeared at the Diet of Worms in 1521, mm-hmm. He was declared an outlaw, mm-hmm. which by the Holy Roman Emperor, the mm-hmm. Holy Roman Emperor nominally ruled over the territory of Spain, what is now Spain and mm-hmm. Netherlands and Switzerland mm-hmm. and Germany and that whole territory, mm-hmm. Austria. Mm-hmm. And once he was declared to be an outlaw, anybody could kill him. Mm-hmm. And he survived in part because of Frederick the Wise, the prince of the territory in which he was living and teaching and being a priest at Wittenberg. Kidnapped him mm-hmm. and hid him in the Wartburg Castle for his own protection for a while. Mm-hmm. And then when things were not going well at Wittenberg in 1521, Luther dressed up as a squire, knight, as a knight, and sneaked back, grew a beard, mm-hmm. and sneaked back into Wittenberg to try to influence what was happening, and much to the displeasure of his prince, who was trying to protect him.
Oh yeah, I think I've seen that movie.
Yes. So his own idea was that he was restoring what was central to Christianity mm-hmm. and to the Catholic Church, and that it was that in his own perception he was being pushed out rather than leaving. Mm-hmm. But of course that depends upon how you're looking at it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Whether you see it that way or another way. Okay. Now so if we can talk a little bit then about this perception of God, the traditional concept of God, which operates pretty much in our society, I find, and was a traditional concept of God in Luther's day in 1500 as well, is a concept that God is seen as mostly being above the world. God is seen as being, in some sense, in control of everything that's happening, in the sense of either causing it to happen or allowing it to happen, either one. And that God is pretty much micromanaging things, so that there is a particular plan for individual lives and so on like that. Now, Luther's idea of God is different from that. Yes, God is majestic. God is awesome. There's no problem with that. But God is very much down to earth, involved in the day-to-day things of the world, even though behind the scenes often, and not easily seen, but there nonetheless. That God is in the midst of conflict, so that God is not sort of in control, but God is right there getting dirtied and bloodied and bruised in the process of trying to accomplish some kind of justice in the world, or achieving some kind of human dignity for the people in the world. And that that God is working through creatures and humans and so on to accomplish what happens in this highly conflicted situation in which things are relatively messy and things are ambiguous and things are not easily understood in the midst of it. And so one needs the insight of the scriptural witness in order to try to get some sense of what God is doing, because it's not easy to look beyond the surface to see what's happening behind the surface. And moreover, God comes to us. Never expected to rise up to God, but God is coming to be with us. And the presence of God, therefore, is always a very, very important, very important theme. Moreover, the work that God does is costly to God. It costs God something to be involved in this way, in this highly conflicted world.
What does that mean?
Costly, in the sense that God suffers, in some sense, from co-experiencing the pain of the people that are involved in the world, and that God pays the price by sending a son who dies, etc., in order to affect in a positive way, reconciling the world. It means, I think, though Luther wouldn't put it this way, I think one could say in my own vocabulary, that it means that God knows what it feels like to fail. That God has plans afoot that are thwarted by human beings in such a way that God also experiences some kind of, we can call it that, failure.
Doesn't that really go counter, though, to the philosophy that God is an omniscient? And
he changes his mind all the time in the Bible.
I think that that's a very important question, but it's one of those I'd like to come back to.
Yeah, I don't mean to.
Yeah. No, I want to come back to it, but bear with me a little bit. Yeah. Hang in there with me a little bit until we come back to it, okay? Because it's very important. Now, the concept of God has been a topic that's been under theological consideration in a specially acute way during the last 50 years. If you think of from about 1960 to the present, 1955 to the present, theologians have been talking a lot about God. I remember being in graduate school in the late 60s, and one of my teachers, Julian Hart, was talking to a philosopher friend of his. And the philosopher said, I went off and read all kinds of theologians trying to find out what they say about God, but they never talk about God. They talk about Jesus, they talk about Christology, the doctrine of Christ, they talk about redemption, they talk about the church, they never talk about God. Well, to some extent that was true of the first half of the 20th century, because the focus was on what we could call second article concerns, the concern of Jesus, the historical Jesus, the nature of Christ, the nature of redemption, and so on. But much of the focus in the last half of the 20th century shifted to God, to first person concerns, first article concerns of God and creation. And there are some reasons for this. One of the reasons for this is massive human suffering. How does one make sense of God's relationship to 11 million innocent people killed in the Holocaust, or 3 million starved out by Stalin in the 1930s, or 1.5 million in Kampuchea, or 800,000 in Rwanda, or go on and on. Needless deaths, preventable deaths, humanly inflicted deaths and suffering. Another reason why this the concept of God has come so much to the surface before has been with all kinds of questions of science and religion. Whether one's talking about evolution, or one's talking about genetic engineering, or one's talking about a whole series of things, the concept of God has come back to the scene. Another reason it's come back on the scene is ecological crisis. What is God's relationship to creation, when and we're trying to think through the crisis and the alternatives, what we do about that crisis. And also all kinds of questions about sexuality are brought into the attention of theologians and church people and so on, because that often comes back to questions of creation and createdness and what createdness means and that kind of thing. So, when we talk about God, it's almost impossible to avoid also talking about creation. And so let me say a couple of words about that and how one would look at creation that would go along with this down-to-earth involved image of God. And the first thing we need to pull into our conversation and our consciousness is the recognition that we have to talk about ongoing creation. That's an ancient Christian idea. It's not a new idea, it's an ancient Christian idea. And it's certainly an idea that Luther endorsed. That creation was not over and done with at some time, but that it's an ongoing thing of God's involvement throughout time, present, past, present, future. And if we do that and talk about ongoing creation, then we have to, and if we hold some conversation with contemporary science, we also have to abandon another idea, and that's the idea of viewing the world under the image of a machine. Because if you view the world as an image of a machine, then you can understand creation as taking place in the past, and God sets up the machine and lets it run all merrily by itself. Just as if I were to create a machine and I get it set up here and going, the only time that I might stop it is to repair it or to adjust it. Otherwise, it would just keep on ticking whether I left the room or didn't come back or whatever. And for contemporary science, it doesn't work to think of the world as a machine, as the degree to which I understand it, at least. And so the alternative has to be some other image. It might be an organic image. It might be an image of electrical charges and motion. It might be a variety of images, but not that of a machine.
I just want to understand your definition. You mean a machine based on the world in 6 days?
By machine, I mean something that is set up in such a way that it can run according to laws without any divine intervention.
Okay.
The kind of deist understanding of God, where God creates it and then goes off and plays his harp on a pink cloud or something while it runs by itself. And then attendant to that notion, if you begin with the notion of a machine, then God's role after that point is interrupting its action. And I would suggest that that's an inadequate image to talk about God's relationship to the world. Also, if the world is not a machine, then God's relationship is not an interrupting action, it is an interaction with the world. This image doesn't work very well and doesn't go very far, but it helps me to think about the world as a little bit more like raising a child. You know, can you imagine that the minute the child is born, deciding, well, I don't have to interact anymore. It's there, it's going to run by itself. It doesn't work, right? There has to be constant interaction between the parent and the child. Likewise, if we understand the world in a more organic image, then there has to be constant interaction between God and the world. And the world is more like a teenage child than like a machine operating by itself. And we all know that teenage children, there's quite a bit of interaction. A different kind of interaction when they're two, but teenagers are battling and tensions and independence and how much independence and all of that. And the world is a little bit more like that, I think, in my own way of thinking. Contemporary scientists will talk about the world not being a clock, but a cloud under the influence of quantum theory and the like. A cloud being that there's lots of indeterminacy about where particles are found, and a lot of, on a subatomic level, there's a lot of imprecision about how things work, even though it comes out at our level as being pretty reliable and pretty clear. Down underneath, there's a lot of chaos, a lot of things that look more like clouds than like clocks. Yeah.
Whenever it's time to get to this, your thoughts on the Trinity then as sort of interconnected or the interactive image for God, does that fit in here somewhere?
Oh yeah, that's a very good question to which I have no ready-made answer. Let's come back. I appreciate your thoughts about that as we come back. Okay. I can hardly see because of the lights here, so I'm trying to get back under the lights to. Now, if we're talking about creation, then it seems to me that another question that comes up immediately is the question of evolution and its relationship to God. So allow me to say a couple words about that, and then we'll come back to the theme, and then we'll come back to your responses. It seems to me that I'm persuaded by John Polkinghorne, who is a British physicist and theologian, that two principles are at work in the world according to contemporary science. And one is the principle of regularity, and the other is the principle of novelty. That the world has both regularity and novelty, and that both regularity and novelty are necessary for evolution to take place. Because if evolution is going to take place according to its contemporary theory, you need to have a mutation, which is the novelty. And the mutation, if it's adaptable to the environment, then can be transmitted to subsequent generations. And in order for it to be transmitted to subsequent generations, you need regularity. Well, Polkinghorne observes that for God, that regularity and randomness or novelty in the world are really related to two attributes of God. Faithfulness of God is related to the regularity we see of patterns in the world. And the love of God is related to this freedom or randomness. For human beings, it's freedom of will. For the world, it's this capacity for novelty and for mutation and for innovation. And God's love is that such as to give to the world freedom. In order for humans to have freedom, there has to be some kind of irregularity or novelty in the world as well, in the natural world. And so these two facets of God are connected with regularity and novelty. And then he goes on to observe that what God has done is to do something really quite remarkable. And he cites non-Christian scientists who come to this conclusion as to create a world that is self-creating. That there is a possibility of growth and change in this world. And that some of that growth and change is what people see through talking about evolution and adaptation and change and so on. And that that's quite a remarkable thing, that God would create a world in which there's creativity within the world itself. And then he observes, on the basis of science as well, that the other remarkable thing about the world is that it's fruitful. And what he means by fruitful is that it's capable of creating life, of life developing and sustaining, of carbon-based life developing. And then one goes back and cites many other scientists other than himself who talk about what a narrow window of exact chemical properties and so on it have to have in order to create the carbon and the oxygen and the other things that are necessary for carbon-based life. So the world is remarkable in the sense that it is self-creating, and it is remarkable in the sense that it is fruitful, And these are important things for understanding the world. Now, so far as we're concerned, therefore, if we take a down-to-earth image of God, then we can say that God is the source of both regularity and novelty in the world. That's part of what Luther was talking about in the ambiguity and the conflictedness of the world. We can say, secondly, that God is like a big magnet drawing the world forward into ever-increasing degrees of complexity, novelty, and so on, drawing it forth into it, drawing life into being, a carbon-based life into being in this world, and that instead of God sort of standing behind and causing them to happen like a machine, God is more out in front, pulling it forward, and God provides a vision of what can be without a detailed plan of how it gets there. There's a self-creating capacity of the world to figure out different avenues or paths of ways to get towards the vision that God has in mind, or to rebel against that vision which God has in mind, either or both. So that also what God is involved in the world on an ongoing basis in such a way as to give to human beings freedom and responsibility. The word that contemporary theology tends to use about this is that humans are co-creators. By co-creators, there's a twofold dimension. The one dimension is that they are free to exercise their own judgment and so on. But they are also responsible in the sense that they have been given responsibility to care for this world, to preserve it, to restore it to what it should be, to heal it, to perfect it, to do all of those things that are important to make it the place that it should be. So what I would suggest is that looking at a down-to-earth image of God suggests that that we have a God who is involved, we have a God who is involved in a way that's costly, and we have a God who expects human beings to be involved, and for human beings it can also, in the co-creatorship of the world, and for human beings it can also sometimes be somewhat costly. The sermon last night, we heard about barley loaves, and if we're going to do justice, it might be barley loaves rather than a more splendid form of food, and there's to some degree costliness there. This morning, John Marty spoke about nonviolence and the way in which, if you're going to be actively involved in nonviolence, this is a commitment like onto fighting a war, in the sense that you have to be ready to be committed and to be to sacrifice a life if necessary. That's a costly involvement in justice doing that we're called to do in order to follow the pattern of God's involvement in the world as a down-to-earth justice-making involvement. A rabbi by the name of Yitz Greenberg, Irving is his name, but he's known as Yitz, an Orthodox rabbi who's involved in Jewish Christian dialogue, which is an unusual thing. He has said that for Judaism and Christianity, central to Judaism and Christianity is a dream. And the dream is the triumph of life. And that what hope is a dream with the discipline to become a reality. And that that the role of religion is in part not only to provide the vision that God has of what things could be, and the vision of what we could participate in may happen, but also to provide the discipline and the community support for the discipline of making this dream into reality. And that requires hope because it's gradual. It doesn't take place overnight, and indeed if you try to force it too fast, it usually is counterproductive. Now I'd like to hear comments, and let's come back to yours.
Well, actually kind of set the wheels in motion for about 15 or 20 different comments that I have, not just going with the first one.
Should we start with the first one?
Well, perhaps so. Okay. That's the image of...
Okay.
of
when Luther talked about omnipotence,
right.
he talked about God giving power to all creatures. That whatever power I have as a creature comes from God. So God is the great, to use my word, energizer of the world. And God energizes in such a way, he talks about in Bondage to Will, as not to determine the result of how a person uses that power. So human beings are given, for Luther, freedom in every possible sense of the word except one. And that one sense is that human beings cannot restore their relationship with God on their own. But in every other way, they're free. And so he talks about even the devil could not exist without the empowerment of God. That the omnipotence of God is the empowering that God gives away to creatures. That all power comes from God, even the power of the devil to exist.
But that, of course, is a vision of God's power that is not shared by a lot of other religions. I think a lot of other religions tend to interpret the omnipotence of God as God is all-powerful and literally controls everything, and in some faith, predestines everything. So everything that happens according to God's will, but that seems to kind of run counter to some of these examples of genocide that had happened here just in the 20th century. What kind of a God would let that happen? How is that part of God's plan? How is that, you just can go on ad infinitum, all the suffering in the world. How can God be in charge of that?
Well, it's as far as Luther is concerned, God is not in that sense directly in charge.
Mm-hmm.
God is giving to human beings gifts, but he's always giving to human beings gifts through other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, for example, in his explanation to the first commandment in the Large Catechism, that all of the things we have, the parents and good things that we get, all come from God through others to us, and that we ought not to wish for another way, because to wish for another way would be to despise the way God has chosen to do it, which is always to come through other creatures and other people. With the question of omniscience, Luther sort of doesn't say much about that. But contemporary theology would say, John Polkinghorne would say, that Terence Fredheim, writing from Luther Seminary, writing about the interpretation of the Old Testament in the suffering of God, would say that there's lots of evidence in the Old Testament that from which we get our concept of God, by the way. God does not literally know the future. That God knows perfectly all that has happened and all that is happening. Therefore, God makes right judgments. God knows more about the future than we know, knows what God will do in the future, but does not literally know in advance what human beings will do.
See, from my perspective, that kind of a role, that kind of a model actually seems to fit and work better than traditional Southern church view of the God that's in charge and he's got the whip and buggy kind of attitude going forth. Because you were talking earlier about how he empowers people to essentially take the driver's seat. But if people really are no better than a 16-year-old kid behind the wheel of a car for the first time, you can see where, for the most part, I guess most of us can kind of get down the road straight with some practice, but there's a lot of train wrecks along the way.
Yep. Yep.
And that seems to speak to why things don't work very smoothly.
Yep. It's a messy world. A self-creating world is a messy world.
But by the same token, and I can't remember now what you were saying, I didn't write this down, but it's like there's a critical mass where God and creation has created this perfect world, this perfectly self-sustaining world, this world that will continue to create on its own. But then when you have humans enter the picture, mankind, it's like we're not really in harmony with that same vision. It's like we are in domination of that vision. And again, train wrecks again.
Yep. Other comments or other observations or questions?
I mean, this is just kind of a mundane example. And I'll tell you where I'm coming from. When I pray in church for a safe journey, I'm not sure I believe it. I mean, is God actually going to keep the flaw in my tire from blowing out and going across the median? You know, I don't think he works down to that level.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
Don't you feel better after you have that prayer? Don't you feel better? I do.
Yes, you do. I do.
But again, if one were to work with contemporary theology on this point, at least the general school of contemporary theology that I'm reflecting in these remarks, which I think is can have lots of similarities to what many things that Luther would say, or that Luther could inform it, or whatever, worked both ways. That particular way of thinking would say that that prayer is a very, very important thing. But prayer is not asking God to put kind of a guard all shield around us or whatever. That what prayer is asking is that we somehow align all of the forces that work in the world, the human forces, the willed forces, and so on, in such a way that the power of alignment occurs. And alignment or orientation is a word that's taken from apparently from lasers, and the way in which you align the light waves and you get a laser with a good deal of power. And so that what we're praying for is to align ourselves with God, and when we pray corporately, to align ourselves with each other in common purpose, so that God and human beings and all works together in such a way as to accomplish that for which we pray. And I believe that's a really very, very powerful role for prayer to have. And if the future is not determined, then prayer really can affect the future. If God knows tomorrow, if God were to know in advance that tomorrow at 2:31 p.m. I was going to have an automobile accident, and he's known that for all eternity, why pray about it?
Yeah, see, that's logical.
It's just set, yeah. And so I think that this opens up a power of prayer in a very significant way for me myself.
Yeah, that just sounds logical to me.
Yeah.
It was meant to be.
And so, where do you go with that?
Well, I guess it just kind of reinforces to me the value and power of prayer.
Yeah.
I mean, it talks many references, in particular in the New Testament, about, you know, if two or more people gather together in my name and pray, you know, it's like, hey, what does that mean? It means I'm paying attention and I'm going to do what I can in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may be other factors involved where maybe that prayer is answered in kind of an oblique fashion. Like, well, I don't understand why I didn't get the answer I was looking for. But that doesn't negate the power of the prayer or the significance of the prayer.
But, and it also makes prayer self-involving. I remember many years ago going to a Catholic church basement in Minneapolis where Neo-Pentecostals were meeting, and there were some like 500 people meeting every Thursday night in basement of St. Albert the Great Roman Catholic Church in Minneapolis during the period when the charismatic movement was at its height. And there was praying in tongues and so on, and one of the persons came to the microphone one week I was there and said, would you pray with me for this family? They had a fire in their house, and all of, you know, the damage and so on had been done. And the next week she came back to the microphone and she said, would you rejoice with me? Because the neighborhood collected X number of dollars to help this family. And as she kept talking, it was very clear that she was the one that had gone around and gotten the collection for the family who was at a fire. I mean, prayer is self-involving if it's understood in the kind of way we're talking about.
Well, I think it's also a way of overcoming fear.
Yeah.
I think that's, in my own experience, it's much greater than that. I think you can, in preparation for your trip, ask for God's protection of you and your family. I think that you can ask for healing for a person, and in my experience, he answers.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that certainly, and we have 5 children, 4 of them are married.
Mm-hmm.
We pray for them regularly.
Sure.
I see things happening in their lives that I believe without prayer, they would not have happened. So yeah, I believe in God's dynamic involvement with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's involvement which has to do with interaction involvement rather than with coming in and sort of interrupting things, this particular way of looking at things would say. And this particular way of looking at things would say the evidence for God's the biblical evidence for this includes the story of the flood, where after the flood is over, the rainbow is given as a sign of a covenant that God will not do this again. In other words, God will not intervene in this destructive way again. And that covenant then commits God to work a different way, still powerfully, still available to prayer, but working in a slightly different way.
But I believe that there are many scholars that feel that what that covenant sign was, that he would not act again in the destruction of the world by water, not necessarily by something else.
That's an alternative interpretation. That's why I said from the point of view that we've been talking about. Yeah.
I'm interested in Rabbi Greenberg's comment, which I tried to write down. Religion provides the discipline, and this is where I paraphrase, to make a dream real, something like that.
Or to make a dream become reality.
Become reality.
Yeah.
That quotation makes me think that in his mind, religion has a great psychological value for individuals. And then when I look back at another note,
individuals and communities, he's thinking communally.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. When I look back at another note I made, you asked the question, how does one think about God in the context of an environmental crisis? And plus the list of catastrophes that have happened in the 20th century, from World War I through today. I am not, well, I go to church, but I am really not a theist. Why do these events that have happened in the last century make us think there really isn't a God? And why do we keep trying to persuade ourselves that there is? And is the new imagery of God being presented by theologians a way of salvaging what we can of God for our own comfort?
Let me try to respond. First of all, let me cite another person. His name is Richard Rubinstein, who was another Jewish rabbi, Jewish thinker, scholar, study of the Holocaust. And he was part of the God is Dead movement of the 1960s. And he said that he was holding a conversation with a pastor in Germany. And the pastor said something, I don't remember exactly what the words were now, which made him think that if one operated under that view of God, then God in some sense had willed the Holocaust to happen. Because if God was the kind of God that was really in control of things, and God was micromanaging in the sense of either causing or allowing specific things to happen, then God was either causing or allowing Hitler to occur in a very direct kind of micromanaged way. And for him, that thought was so repugnant that he said, I'm giving up on that concept of God. And therefore he rejected the whole concept of theism and replaced it by a sense of God being the divine, not God as a separate being, but the divine being in creatures. And that you have different cycles of nature and divine and so on. Well, the point is, the reason I bring this up is that one reason to say no to God, God doesn't exist, is if one assumes that view of God, which I'm trying to find an alternative to. If one assumes God is in control and God is micromanaging and one has massive suffering, it just doesn't work. One of the traditional answers for why, what God's relation to suffering is that God allows people to suffer for a higher good. Well, on an individual level, that often makes a lot of sense. My home community, one Thanksgiving, family's house burned down, and the whole community came together and cleaned up an abandoned house and gave them furniture and provided the clothing and so on. And this large family, you know, one could say it was worth it for the community to have that happen. I don't want to argue whether it's a rational thing that one could say. But people said, 11 million deaths. What possible good could outweigh that plus all the other suffering that went on in addition to those deaths? And they have a tendency to answer. So what it has done is to drive them back to look at the history and to look at the scriptures again and to say, look, we probably misread the scriptures. And rather than being an attempt to kind of salvage a theism that's really past its day, it's a kind of acknowledgement that that theism of that particular way of understanding it was probably not right in the first place. 43 times in the Old Testament, God changes God's mind on the basis of human action. And yet the tradition has said that God is literally unchanging. Well, something's wrong there.
Right.
They didn't get it from the scriptures.
Right.
Where did they get it from? They got it from a philosophical idea that the ancient world had. And that philosophical idea said that if God is perfect, then God cannot change. Because either God would change from being imperfect to imperfect in a different way, or God would change from being imperfect to perfect, or God would change from being perfect to imperfect, and you couldn't have God perfect on both sides of the change. So it was a philosophical idea that prompted the ancient world to think that God couldn't change, and therefore to read the Old Testament differently from what it appears to say. And so, rather than salvaging, it's really reclaiming a biblical tradition from what has been lost.
Right, reclaiming. But still, I mean, this other Jewish individual you mentioned,
Rubinstein?
Yeah, Richard Rubinstein. Still believed, when he came to the conclusion he was not going to believe in the God he had believed in, he still believed that there was something divine in human beings and in the world.
That's
and
right.
In the universe.
He calls himself
and
the
pagan. I'm asking, why do we still believe that there's something divine?
Well, that's a whole another question.
and do you think about that? And
oh yeah.
What would you say as a preliminary question?
Because we're running out of time, isn't it about, we're close to 6:05, aren't we? Let me try to give you a quick, inadequate answer.
That's good.
John Polkinghorne says that when you look at the world, you don't see any knockdown arguments for the existence of God, but you see some evidences that could lead you in that direction, and then you have to decide which is the more rational conclusion. One of the evidences that he puts forth is the amazing capacity of human reason to understand the world. Why is it that a mathematician sitting in his office constructing a mathematical theory that's purely abstract winds up discovering something that when a physicist comes along actually applies to the world? There's some kind of amazing congruence between what happens in our minds and what's going on in the world as the scientists discover. So he'd say, well, how do you explain that? One possible way to explain that is to say that the world has a creator. Another evidence, the fruitfulness of the world that we talked about. this amazingly, just ever so slight difference in the valence of atoms, and we wouldn't have carbon-based life. And you say, well, you could talk about that as chance, but the scientists who talk about it as chance say, you have to have a million different universes then, or millions of different universes, in order to explain why it was that by chance this particular one was fruitful. He said, it makes more sense to me to say that there's a divine agent causing, you know, designing this in some way, having a vision for what it can be, and so on. It just seems to me to be a more reasonable and a more elegant, which is a scientific principle, aesthetic principle, a more elegant answer to the question than this unnecessary multiplication of universes. And one could go on with a series of things like that, it seems to me, to be able to, that I would want to say, that makes me think that it is a plausible, rational judgment that there is a God. Now, that doesn't mean I can prove that God exists. I don't mean that. But that it is a plausible way to deal with certain kinds of things that we see in the world. And then I would go on to talk about other important things like the role of belief in God in human life and what that does and there's a certain pragmatic argument that it is ennobling. The religion has had this effect of calling people to what I would really desire that human beings be anyway. So, now, of course, there have also been some perversions of religion, but at its best, looked at its best, it has had a remarkably good effect in the world and on human society, and therefore I think that it has some validity for humans as well. So that's not a, it's nowhere near a complete answer to your question, but it hints at some directions I would want to go with. Okay. All right, I feel like at least I feel for myself like I just got started, but an hour's over. I will try to do the rest of them somewhat independent, but they're also going to build on each other. The next one tomorrow at 6:20, we'll talk about the centrality of relationships in restoring the world, and the centrality of relationships as understood in Lutheran tradition. And then on Wednesday, I think it's in the morning, talks about the role of reason and wisdom and in this tradition, importance for sustaining the world. Thursday about community, and Friday about ethical principles that come out of all this. So these are tied to each other and build on each other, but I'm trying to make them separate so people can come and go as well. We just got started. Thank you for coming.